are listening to the Elephant in the Room podcast with your host, Sutta Singh. Each week, we will bring you a diverse range of inspiring speakers on issues of inequality and inequity. You will hear stories about fairness, justice, belonging, and about best practice for creating a more inclusive workplace. So, if you are an individual or leader interested in a fairer, equitable, compassionate society and workplace, this podcast is for you.
My guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast this week is Dipali Gupta, a business journalist with nearly two decades of experience, having worked with the Indian Express Group, Network 18, Dow Jones, The Wall Street Journal, and The Economic Times in India. Dipali is also the author of Tata vs. Mistry, The Battle for India's Greatest Business Empire. She has recently relocated to the UK along with her family. Good morning, Dipali. Thank you for being a guest on the Elephant in the Room podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here. It's lovely to be here.
Let's get started with the questions. Can you introduce yourself and tell us something about your background and your education?
So I've been a journalist for a little less than two decades. I started with the Indian Express Group, then went away to Dow Jones and the Wall Street Journal, and finally settled into a nice role at the Economic Times. I quit the Economic Times towards the end of 2018 with a mission to write a book. You know the outcome of that. It's called Tata vs. Mistry. And to be honest, I landed in journalism purely accidentally. I come from a family of professionals who are overachievers in their academic fields, and I wasn't one of those. So even though the charter for me was perhaps to follow a PhD in physics or in coding and science related, I don't think I fell in that category. So when I finished my college, the Hindu group came and gave me an offer and said, well, you finished English literature. Why don't you consider this as a profession?
Wow.
And that actually took me to St. Xavier's to go on and finish a post-graduation in journalism per se. In hindsight, there couldn't have been a better profession for me. But this was a field that gave me a foot in every door. It allowed me to ask questions. So I landed up covering technology from an enterprise perspective, from an innovation perspective. I covered pharmaceuticals. And again, the jargon over there can be quite intimidating, but it's fun once you've gotten the hang. I did equity markets, financial policy, RBI policy. And that breadth of coverage kind of landed me into a role in mergers and acquisitions and conglomerates. And that, of course, is, like I said, it all sort of lines up to
where you are. Yeah, to the book. So how easy or difficult was it to make yourself heard as a female journalist covering finance? And how likely is it that you'll succeed as a female journalist in India?
So to be honest, this is a very welcoming profession for women, contrary to perception. So when I joined journalism, the perception was that this is a dirty profession for loose girls. Right. I don't think that I agree with that. I think that my experiences have all largely been clean. Yes, you have that occasional brush, but I think that's true in life in general. So my newsrooms have always been clean. It's been a great arena to foster conversation, to foster intellectual thought. And I do think that you are seen as a peer in the newsroom. That said, I think the hours are needed. And at some point in your life, in my case, I went through maternity, and there is a lean period, but I don't think that you can grudge anyone else putting in more hours than you. Your focus had changed, you went away and did something else, and then you came back to it. And by the time you've come back to it, so if you're writing regularly, then you continue to get that much more. Breaking back into that feels like you're reinventing the wheel. But I mean, that's par for the course. It's true for any profession. I think journalism is one of those professions, also because it's public. You can always very openly collate what your success rate has been. But it's a great profession for women.
It's interesting to hear that. So you decided to write about one of the most respected groups in India. They're also conservative and reticent about washing any dirty linen in public. What made you decide to write Tata vs. Mistry,
Okay, so let's go back to the journey. Now, I've been writing on Tata companies from the beginning of my career. I mean, if you track finance in India, then it's very hard to not write about a Tata company. They're in everything. Yeah. And I think from TCS in tech to Tata Chemicals, they're everywhere. So I've written about various Tata companies throughout my career. In 2016, when all of this was unfolding, I was very actively involved with covering an issue that the group was having with their Japanese partner in the telecom ventures. Yeah, this was NTT Docomo. And it was a very bitter feud which was going on between the Japanese partner and the Tata group about settling some arrears on equity. It was bitter to the point that governments had been involved. I mean, the prime ministers of the two countries had had a conversation about it. So I was in the thick of that. And on the Friday before the final firing, I got a call from a source saying, "Watch out for Monday. I can't say anymore." And he hung up the phone. And I said, "Watch out for Monday? Okay, let me go back and think about it." And I said, "Well, this has to relate to Tata Docomo." So I went through my entire contact book. And I didn't find anything. There was no major development going on in Tata versus Docomo. Then it just sort of passed, right? The weekend came around. You got busy with other things. And then Monday came. The board meeting was scheduled for Monday. But it didn't seem like anything was going to happen. Because prior to the board meeting, there was no announcement. So I flagged to someone in my office that, you know, just keep an eye out. There's this board meeting going on. Something may come from it. And I went away to another meeting at an office. And I'm sitting with this executive, and in his office on one wall is a television screen which is running a ticker. My phone is kept on the table. Suddenly my phone buzzes. And then on the ticker, it says Cyrus Mystery fired. And the person says, "You journalists, you'll write anything to be able to get an exclusive. Look at this. I mean, how can Cyrus Mystery be fired?" Yeah. And well, I mean, to be honest, nobody had ever thought that something like that would happen, that at such short notice. And my phone continues to buzz. So I said, "You know what? I'm really sorry to cut our meeting short, but let me just step out and take this." And so I stepped out, and it was, in fact, a firing. And the release was a one-line release. "As of tomorrow, he will not be coming back to office." So I rushed back to my office. And then, of course, the next day, battle lines were drawn. So it was just one of those stories, you know, stakes were high, drama was high. But more importantly, this turned out to be a churn of stories for a period of 3 or 4 months, where every day it was a front page article about what was going on and who was saying what about the group. And there were leaks from inside. There were sources who were calling us up to say, "Well, you know, have you looked at this aspect?" Really, really involved on the day-to-day coverage of what was unfolding. And 2 years later, by the time the judgment came out, the dust had kind of settled. People didn't remember. It took all of us a minute and a Google search to be able to go back and see what it was that the key points were. So when we looked at that first judgment of the NCLT that came out, in my mind, this was a growing up moment for corporate India. It spanned well beyond the Tata Group. And that was the reason why I decided to pick up the subject.
So how did you go about preparing for this book that was going to generate a lot of interest and scrutiny from all quarters, including, of course, legal? You mentioned that you had to change your publisher at one stage.
So the starting point was my very first interview when I phoned up this gentleman and I said, "I want to write on this subject. I want it to be chronicled for what it was. Can I come in and have a chat with you?" And the interview was fantastic. He gave me wonderful quotes and he gave me a lot of salacious gossip. And then I got up and I said, "Thank you very much. It was lovely talking to you." He said, "But you must remember one thing. This entire interview was off the record. And if he ever comes back to me, then I will say that I never spoke to you or have never met you." And at that point, you know, it was 1 hour of complete, you know, I was rubbing my hands 1 minute and I was on the floor in a puddle in the second. But that kind of made me realize that everything needs to be corroborated, everything needs to be chronicled, and everything needs to be documented very carefully if I was going to write on this subject. And so began the research process. The first step was to go to the libraries. And because both of these are very, very old established business houses, the older libraries like the Asiatic Society and some of the other ones in Mumbai do actually have a longish chronicle of what has happened with them. I went and made friends in strange offices like the Charity Commissioner of Mumbai. It's this little, slightly dilapidated office, which is dusty and has a whole lot of pews running around. And it has only manual records, nothing digital.
Oh my God.
But it has all the records of the Tata Trusts, which kind of oversee the Tata business. They have a majority stake in Tata Sons. So I went and I frequented that office a fair deal to bring out some of the establishment deeds of the trusts and some of the public disclosures that are made there. Newspaper archives were my friends.
Yeah.
My PR colleagues were really surprised. Because I called up a couple of them and I said, well, you know what? I'd like to interview you. You've been in the thick of things. But of course, I couldn't tell them why I wanted to meet them on the phone. Because by this point, I wasn't sure anymore how much scrutiny I was going through. So I just told them that, can we meet? Hmm. And one of them actually came with a list of possible things that could have gone wrong with me that they would want to correct. And I said, well, you know what? No, I have no complaints. I actually want the tables to be flipped for a change where I'm asking you questions and I want you to tell me what your experiences have been. And then, of course, came the lawyers who are so suave and who know exactly how to spin you around in circles. But I did get some pointed answers, even in those legal offices. And so by the time I was done, I had plenty of information, a pile of about 9,000 pages worth of documents, and of course, all the other books and papers which I had collated. So it was reasonably well documented by the time I got around to that.
That must have been like really a huge exercise. Both the Tata Group and Shapoorji Pallonji are hugely admired and have a legacy of philanthropic activity, putting people before profit sort of approach. So what went wrong and what was at the heart of the hugely public breakup from a governance point of view? The reason why I'm talking about this on the Elephant in the Room podcast, I think, as you said, that this is a growing up moment for corporate India. And this is sort of a seminal moment. And then things have become better after that, hopefully.
At the very base, I would say the issue was of communication at its most basic. But I think if you take it to the next level, I think it's a matter of perspective. Ideally, in any organization, you want the maverick innovation of Steve Jobs as well as the financial prudence of Jack Welch. But in real life, those two managerial positions are at contravention to each other. What happened was the difference between a promoter's perspective and a professional's perspective. The Tata Group has historically never been one to chase profits. They've always chased futuristic planning, cutting edge technology. If you look at their charter, which dates back to the early 1900s, the charter is to further science in India. The charter is to create innovation in India. And it's not so much balancing out profits. And therefore, the point of view that the previous chairman of Tata have come at the group has always been that of innovation and of fostering growth at perhaps the cost of profit. Now, if you look at it, Cyrus Mistry was the very first non-Tata family chairman to come and take that seat. And by this time, the group is so large that it's answerable to stakeholders, not just shareholders, but there are banks involved, there are international arms involved, there are governments involved. And therefore, he has to come at it from a professional perspective. And therein lies the need to meet profit focus, to meet shareholder expectations, to have image building. And just before this entire firing, there is this article that The Economist has written about flab in the Tata Group, and that Cyrus Mistry has been unable to cut that flab back.
Yeah.
And you know, what the shareholder community is expecting is very different from what the traditional point of view has been. And therefore, I think if you were to ask me where was the single point of failure in that relationship, I think it is this. I think that they are not coming at the problem from the same perspective.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It has raised a lot of questions, including, you know, those around succession planning. What are the lessons to be drawn from this conflict?
So let's analyze a little bit about what the succession process was for the Tata Group. Why was Cyrus Mistry chosen to be the person to succeed Ratan Tata? At the end of the day, that list of 14 people who were being interviewed included the CEO of Pepsi globally, the co-chair of Deutsche Bank. So why was Cyrus Mistry a better fit for the role than some of these other people? And I think the answer to that lies in what is documented in the minutes of the board meeting where he's appointed, to say, well, he is the outsider insider. He's not someone who is completely from the outside, but at the same time, he is not completely on the inside. And while that was supposed to work out rather well, it also put him, again, in the wrong place, because there's the founder perspective who's thinking, well, he understands this perspective and he'll fall in line. And there is the shareholder perspective who's thinking, well, he's an outsider, he's not an insider. Therefore, he will think about it in a different way. So it does put him in that spot. And as succession goes, therefore, what is the process? Now, the process itself of selecting him was rather strange. He was a committee member on the selection team. He was not supposed to be a candidate at all. He was someone who was interviewing candidates. I mean, if you're looking at family succession, for instance, the child of a promoter is often involved with many of these things. Therefore, can you say that this is an independent selection and an independent succession plan? And it's not necessary that it's always the best thing for the company. In many cases, it is better to get a family member who will be passionate and who will think about the company as their baby, rather than a professional who is looking to get a salary and then check some boxes and get on with life. Right. So the fact that all the eggs of a promoter are in the basket, the organization may actually play to the strength of the organization. Therefore, every organization has to consider which process, but the mingling of the process is probably not a good idea. It's either an independent process where you get a professional chief, or from the outset, you set out to say, well, this is going to be a family thing.
Yeah.
So that's the process of selection. And of course, it also opened up the process that companies could follow. Things that can go wrong. Things that they should be wary of. So this was a big lesson in succession planning. And I think any other group would not have been taken as seriously. But because the Tata Group is associated with its transparency and its generally good governance practices, they tend to set a precedent for everyone to follow. This was a widely watched succession.
It's not unusual for chairman CEOs to lose trust of the board or shareholders. Steve Jobs was fired. Anshu Jain had to quit. Boardroom conflicts are inevitable. But there are other ways of managing this conflict. How can organizations prepare to deal with that conflict?
Conflicts are inevitable. I mean, if there's human emotion involved, and often there is, especially in promoter-driven companies, then conflicts are inevitable. But things that organizations can do is to put in place a mechanism of how to address these conflicts if they do come up. For instance, there can be a sort of a blueprint on when there is a disagreement between management and the board, what steps will be taken. Perhaps there's a third-party evaluation that needs to happen between what the board is saying and what the management is saying. That said, the chief way of resolving any conflict is communication and understanding, mutual understanding, because the board is still dependent on what the management discloses to it. No matter how deep the board may want to get into the details of the organization, it is its key directors or key executives that control the flow of that information. So in some cases, what companies do is to create multiple lines of reporting. So for instance, apart from the CEO, the chief legal officer and the chief financial officer have separate dotted lines to the board. But again, it comes down to the same thing. It comes down to resolving conflicts with communication and full disclosure. So what leaders can do to foster this is, one, ensure that there is completely open communication between various levels within the organization. Ensure that there is some sort of a one-on-one rapport that gets set up between the top few echelons of the organization. Failing these, there is always the option of third-party mediation. And of course, at all points in time, what safeguards any organization is to let the independent directors in fact be independent. Instead of trying to partner them and have offline meetings or build consensus, if independent directors can be allowed to have their own views and their own thoughts without perhaps being at the risk of being axed from the board, then they themselves can become mediators for when there is a conflict such as the ones that we've seen. There are few examples, but I don't think that they are publicly disclosed. I mean, conflicts can arise for the strangest of reasons. In 2017, I think there was the Kotak committee report, which said, well, part of good corporate governance is creating a succession plan. And that created endless amount of conflict. I mean, it was a really uncomfortable scene for many boards because the other board members had to nominate a potential successor for someone who was sitting in the room and who would probably not agree with a potential successor. And in some cases, there was a nomination of someone who was still in a very early grooming stage and therefore perhaps not completely ready for a potential takeover. But the idea of the report and the governance suggestion was that this should be someone who can quickly step into the shoes in case there is a last minute or a crisis situation.
If you look at the leadership style, at least Mr. Tata, he has been a sort of a benevolent leader, and the focus have been largely on innovation, you know, promotion of sciences and technology for society and for India.
It's also a presentation of snapshots. So whether a certain business decision was a good decision or a bad decision often is governed because of the snapshot in that moment. There was a time when Jaguar Land Rover looked like a terrible acquisition for the Tata Group. And if you took a snapshot at that moment, it seemed like it was a bad decision.
Yeah.
Forward 3 more years and you realize that Tata Motors is running losses, but Jaguar Land Rover is sort of kicked in. You look at today's date, they are hugely successful in their electric vehicle segment. And that seems to be the pivot internationally. So if you look at it now, it seems like a great move back then. Similarly, Corus, when it was acquired, it was an acknowledgement moment of Indian corporates becoming MNCs, of truly becoming global. When Cyrus Mistry was dealing with some of it, it seemed like a bad moment because he was dealing with closures and pension overheads weighing down on the company. So again, depending on which snapshot you took of the company, you could say it was a great decision or a bad one.
That is true. It's all about perspective, as you said. And the role of independent directors has come under huge scrutiny, right, post that episode. So how independent they really are, and can they act impartially if they are under constant threat of being removed?
So independent directors were really put on the spot. I'm sure you're familiar with the SEBI guideline that came out, the Kotak committee report on the role and the operations of an independent director. But yes, so on one hand, there is the question of agreeing with your promoter or your founder, which clearly seems to have been the case for the main Tata Sons board meeting in which Cyrus Mistry was fired. The minutes of that meeting, again, which are detailed in the book, show that all of the directors seemed to know that this was coming. It appears that all of them are falling in line with a pre-decided notion to remove him. In hindsight, I think there is no doubt that didn't happen. And then you have the flip side of it, which played out in the Indian Hotels board meeting, where the Indian Hotels independent director said, well, if we fire Cyrus Mistry today, then are we saying all the decisions that we have stood by in the last 4 years, we have just been following Cyrus Mistry blindly and we were in fact wrong about those decisions? Or do we stand by our old decisions and say, no, Cyrus Mistry cannot be fired? They went with the latter. Right. So, yeah. So therein lies the discrepancy. And I think the subsequent issues which came up with the Indian Hotels board meetings, with the Tata Steel board meeting, and the final divide between directors spearheaded by Nusli Wadia highlighted that independence can, in fact, be enforced even if there is a majority shareholder.
This is so interesting. So India is a country which is still overrun by family-owned, professionally run businesses. What are the lessons that they need to draw from this? And how can they recognize and embrace the difference in perspective of a promoter and a professional? Is it happening anywhere?
It happens all the time. And I think increasingly, as Indian businesses mature, it's going to continue happening. So far, I think we still have a lot of first-generation entrepreneurs. And by first generation, I mean people who founded businesses in the 80s, 90s, who still continue to oversee their businesses. If you look at the next generation in these businesses, this is a generation that has gone to the best universities around the world, learned from the best and come back, and is not looking at business the same way as their parents did. There is a confluence of venture capital, which again adds to the element of neutrality and less dependence. But family-run businesses anywhere in the world are the same. I mean, India is not dramatically different from anywhere else in the world. It's growing up. Its corporate history is not as deep as perhaps some of the developed nations. But yes, this was, like I said, in my opinion, this was a growing up moment. A lot of the second generation looked at this. A lot of the families started to family plan. There was subsequently creation of trusts and handover of equity, which determined how succession would work, when it would go from being a family-run or family-owned business to being a professionally-run business. And like I said, in some cases, they did actually find that it's better to keep it in the family. Lego is a family-run business, and it's hugely successful. So in some cases, it is in the interest of the company to keep it in the family just because of the commitment and the passion that an owner-promoter is going to show towards it. I would say that there were other cases like the whole Infosys issue that happened with the promoter going in and out. So it's not just one instance of Tata and Mistry, but this combined with a couple of other major instances have really created a thought change in the Indian leader today.
Yeah. What do you believe has been the impact?
I think it'll always be a blip in their history, but it's a very large group. And it's a finely run group. It still continues to have its charter of furthering science and technology and looking ahead of trends and for the betterment of the country itself.
You've had a long career and you've written a book. Any advice for budding female journalists and what are the skills they should be honing?
So advice and on skills, just keep an open mind. As a journalist, you have to be a lifelong learner. And I mean, I have youngsters who come out there and talk to me about NFTs and cryptocurrency, which, well, I'm happy to sit down and let them coach me. So keep an open mind and ask questions. This is one profession where you can go out and ask as many questions as you like, and you can ask the world's stupidest question and nobody will call you stupid for it. So go ask as many questions as you can.
From your experience, what are the key attributes of a good author? How important is resilience?
I think the most important attribute of a good author is the ability to take in feedback. As writers, I know I do it, we tend to be very defensive of our own work. And it's difficult to see things from another perspective because we've invested the kind of time we have and we've tried to do our best already. But to be able to take feedback from others and then use it to the betterment of the final piece of work is something that really differentiates a good author from another one.
And what is next for you?
So like I said, I'm looking at writing one more book, which is massively delayed because of COVID. I mean, the whole world has been in turmoil over it. But yes, there is the second book which is coming. And of course, over the summer, we relocated to the UK. And well, it was a bit of a confluence it was destiny, perhaps. But it was a confluence of circumstances which landed me in the lap of a nascent magazine called Opto, that's trying to pivot a content strategy. And I'm here, I'm writing on international equities for Opto, and of course, waiting to finish my second book.
So all the best for that. And thank you so much for your time. And it's been such an interesting conversation. I have had to consciously actually stop myself from asking more because this, I think, could go on and on. So thank you so much for your time.
No, it's been lovely to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me on the cast.
Thank you for joining us this week on the Elephant in the Room podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to the show on any of your favorite platforms, iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts. And if you enjoyed listening to the podcast today, don't forget to write a review and tell your friends. Sign up on the link in the show notes to receive updates on our guest speakers, blogs, and events. And don't forget to tune in every Thursday for new episodes.